What I wanted to do today is to recap what we did last Wednesday and then give a very basic example of solving the scalar wave equation in Julia, either using live coding or if it's a smaller group, I can also let do that yourself. And if it's a larger group, then of course it would need to move slowly, but with a smaller group, I can adapt my speed to however experienced you are. So how experienced are you? Can't judge. All of you are very good, obviously, no problem. So let me briefly walk through the Julia notebook and that I prepared last week. Did you all follow last week? You all nodding? Very good. I also uploaded the notebook in the GitHub repository in case you didn't manage to do that. So let's briefly go through the notebook top to bottom. This is the example function I used. It's a Gaussian that's a bit offset. And what we did was we discretized the function and look at the discretization error. The basis functions were hat functions. That's the definition of the hat function that are introduced here. This is one sample hat function for a particular resolution displayed. Then I introduced a type for discrete functions called fun. And fun form a vector space, so I added functions to add and subtract these functions. One function to sample a function and restrict from the continuum to the discrete vector space. And you played around with that a bit. And of course, the opposite, an evaluate function that takes the discrete function and produces a continuous function from that again, called evaluate. And then when you plot, you can take the Gaussian, discretize it, and convert it back to a continuum function. And then you get this one here, of course, with the correct resolution. You see with your eye how big the errors are. If the resolution is a bit better, you don't see the error. This is the same for a higher resolution. To actually look at the error, I introduced the quadrature function. Quadrature is just an integral, a numerical integral over the function. And you can use that to calculate the error. If you take the difference between two discrete functions, the absolute value squared, and then you integrate over that, that gives the L2 norm of the error. This is the L2 norm function, the L2 norm of a particular discrete function, first pointwise, because we use a position basis. I can calculate pointwise the absolute value squared for all the coefficients. Then I create a new function called the quadrature function and the square root because it's I want the L2 norm. And then in the end, we compare different resolutions. That was a bit more complicated. We take a function, discretize with a particular resolution h. We take the function again, discretizing with a higher resolution, say h over 2. And then we need to move them into the same discrete function space to compare them. So we need the function with a resolution h and rediscretize it with a resolution h squared, and then, sorry, h over 2. And then we can subtract the h over 2 functions. So and can calculate the error. And I drove that to the extreme up until here, discretizing that function g with 20,000 points and evaluating it, discretizing it with 40,000 points and evaluating it, and then rediscretizing the 20,000 point functions with 40,000 points. And then I calculate the L2 norm of the difference. And the difference here is something 10 to the minus 8. And if you look at the errors, if you use 200 points, the error is 10 to the minus 4. With 20,000 points, the error is 10 to the minus 8. So if you kind of square the number of points, or if you take 100 times more points, the error decreases by a factor 10,000. That is the quadratic convergence that I mentioned. And based on this notebook, today I want to show you how to actually solve a hyperbolic partial differential equation. As I mentioned, if you do that really, it would be good to create a Julia package, including test cases. But what I'm showing today is just the notebook because that makes it easier for me to run things and to show things. So what I didn't do is actually calculating a derivative of the discrete function. That's the first thing I'm going to implement. How does this work? Code, markdown. Discrete derivatives. So we have a function and want to calculate a derivative. And I hope you can help me code this. Function deriv, the function f, fun of type t. Can one of you help me out here? Do you recall how we calculate derivatives for these piecewise linear continuous functions? Half of you seems bored, the other half seems stressed out. Pardon?
Finite differences?
Yes, yes, these are finite differences. Okay, I'm going to sketch it on the blackboard. If there is a if there's a discrete function and we want to calculate the derivative at this point here, there's a right derivative and the left derivative. Can you see the blackboard?
Sorry, can I ask a question just about the code you already wrote? When you write, to find a function, you name it deriv, then you're saying it's going to act on f, f is of this type.
Yes.
And then what's with the two colons when you do fun t again? Because
in the end.
Previously you just said where t.
That just says that the function returns also a function of type t.
Okay.
You don't need to write that. Julia infers it. But I like to add it kind of as documentation so that also if you accidentally return something completely different, Julia will complain. And that's for that.
Okay. Thank you.
So finite differences, the second order centered finite difference is the average of the right finite right and the left limit of the finite difference here. So, and of course, this averaging does not work at the leftmost and at the rightmost point. So I need to introduce a special case. And since I need to calculate all the coefficients of the derivative function, I'm going to do that point by point. I'm going to first allocate an array that holds the new coefficients. How do you allocate an array with a particular size? Similar. Similar just gives you a new array that has the same type and dimension as the old array. And then we loop over the points, but we keep it consistent by using the same notation. Sorry, I need to calculate n from last time. I'm just copying from what I wrote last time out of convenience. We need n and h. Now the special case, if we are at the leftmost point, then we also can only calculate the right limit of the derivative. So if I equals 1, and the slope of this function is the value of the coefficients, that coefficient minus that coefficient divided by the width, which was h. And similar for the rightmost point. There I can only calculate a left derivative. And in the general case, I calculate the average between these two derivatives. Okay, now I want to plot the derivative just to see whether it looks good. That's always a good idea. I need to remind myself how to plot something. Okay, what did I call g last time? Just a generic function. And then there was g11. Was it this? No. Oh, there was no underscore. I think g11 coefficients, yes, g11 coefficients was a discrete function. So let me calculate it like that. Oh, no. Okay. There's an error. Aha, very good, yes. Do you see the error in the function?
Anything?
I don't return anything. I calculate all the coefficients, but I don't actually calculate the result.
But Julie was supposed to complain if you
didn't. It did. Yeah, cannot convert.
Oh, okay.
That was it complaining. Yes, I have a new function here. And dg11. Is this how I calculate a continuous function again? Sorry, I need to scroll up to actually. I forgot the conventions that I introduced last time. O of x, okay. And then let me look at the plot command again. And then once I'm convinced, it actually looks okay. dg11. That is clearly the derivative of a Gaussian. It looks right, does it not? Kind of looks good. Let me also draw the original function.
Eric?
Yes?
When you divide by 2h?
Yes.
You don't need any parentheses or multiplication sign?
I think you don't. So this is the function here. You talk about that term.
Yes,
Julia has a convention. That's just a notation that makes it slightly easier to write complicated equations. If you multiply a variable with a scalar factor that is directly given, then you just write it in front of it. And you cannot have a space in here, but you don't need to do anything, and it binds more closely than writing anything else. I could also write 2 times h. That would be the same thing. And it just makes some equations look nicer, and therefore they introduced that, essentially just showing off that they could do that. And here I plotted the original function. That was the Gaussian, the discretized Gaussian. And this is the derivative of the discretized Gaussian here. And should we go over the derivative function again? Maybe not. Okay. I want to show you one thing, that the derivative of a discretization is for finite difference is different than the discretization of a derivative. So we have this function g, which is the Gaussian. Let me just scroll up and copy the derivative here. This is the Gaussian function that we have. Screen is a bit small. Sorry for all the scrolling here. And I want to define the derivative. That is dg. And now I need to, in my head, calculate the derivative. This is minus 40 times 2 times, is this correct? Doesn't seem right, right? What's the derivative of that? Like that? Okay.
Can we see the function again?
Yeah, good point. Of course, I deleted it. Haha. No, sorry, I need to scroll up just a second. Yep, it's that one. I'll copy it down there as a comment, then we can see what it looks like. top is the function, and the second is supposed to be the derivative.
And that's why I have to do the derivative function.
Pardon?
The function is doing taking the derivative.
No, dg is just supposed to be the derivative of the Gaussian.
No, just.
The derivative function. Okay, that one, yeah, sorry. Yeah, everything's a function here, of course. Yes. I thought you were going to help me calculate the derivative here. Okay. You have a particular question, or should I go through it again? So we're calculating n and h in the same time we calculated last time. I allocate an array that holds the coefficients of the derivative. Then we loop over all the points. There are special cases for the leftmost and the rightmost point. So I equals 1 and I equals n are the special cases. And the coefficients for these points, well, for the leftmost gate, it's 2 minus 1 divided by h, n and n minus 1. And here for the average, where we take the average of the two things, they're actually, it does not depend on point I because that cancels out left and right. So you just have I plus 1 and I minus 1 divided by 2h.
The two semicolons with the fun T after the parentheses. Like at the first line of the function. The name of the function.
This one here?
Yeah, that's where it returns type or
something. I know the answer.
That, yes, please.
It just means that the edge code is going to be of that type. And you don't have to have it there, but sometimes it's nice to have it there in case it gives you the wrong edge code because it won't be there.
Yeah. Actually, the error message that we saw earlier was exactly because of that term. Because Julia thought the function would return nothing because it didn't return anything. And then it also thought it should return something of the type fun t. So I tried to convert nothing to fun t, and there was no function, conversion function declared, and that was the error message. It's not a really good error message telling me what's wrong, but it told me what to do. Okay, now here this is the function and the Gaussian. Now I want to plot the derivative of the Gaussian, which looks like that. And now I'm going to discretize the derivative. So what I'm now trying to do is look at the difference between a discretization of a derivative and the derivative of a discretization. And these two operations don't actually converge. So No. Sorry about all these names. Now it's really confusing. I need to call sample now, right? And I'm running out of good names here. This was dgb coefs, and then I have dg 11b equals f. And then I'm going to plot that as well. Stack trace. Okay. I'm going to restart my kernel and run all cells. I typed something that I shouldn't have typed.
Can we just see the cells above that?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Which one?
You did.
This one?
No more. Before the plot, the first. Yeah, there. There. Sorry. A little bit more.
It scrolled by itself. Sorry, that wasn't me.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. Which one? Oh, no, I deleted all the output because it's recalculating it.
So then, just after the derivative function.
Okay.
Yeah, there. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. While Julia is busy, I'm going to draw something on a blackboard. Let's assume you have a function f of x, a continuous function, and you discretize it. Then you get a function, let's call it f twiddle of x. And you can also calculate the discrete derivative. That's our deriv function that we have here. Deriv, then you get something like whatever, nabla twiddle f twiddle of x. Nabla because it's the derivative, nabla twiddle because it's the discrete version of the derivative that we implemented on the discretized function. You can also calculate the derivative of f of x directly. This would then gradient f of x. And if you discretize this function, then you get something that is about, what would it be? Nabla f twiddle of x, where you, I mean, and you see that these are in general not the same. If you take a derivative first and then discretize the function, that is a different thing than first discretizing and then calculating a derivative. Of course, if you do a convergence test and increase the resolution more and more, these two should converge to each other in terms of these L2 norm. You can't see that? Okay, yeah, going to have to switch on the light.
Scroll further down
the line.
Sorry. Please.
Does it make sense now?
Can you have a look on the next cells?
Look at what?
The following cells. Yeah.
So here, just where I'm plotting, here I'm plotting the discrete function, this is just plotting. And here I'm manually calculating the derivative of the g, which looks like that. Then I'm discretizing, and it looks like that. And oh, now, I need to read. Okay, yeah, oof. I think my screen is not large enough. Let me try to make it a bit smaller. Is the difference visible?
Yep.
Maybe barely. Well, maybe the most striking point is that amplitude of the functions is very different. One of them has a maximum amplitude of 4, and the other one has a maximum amplitude of 6. So the result is different. Of course, they're kind of similar. This is a very coarse discretization, right? Because you're just using 11 grid points. Obviously, the error is huge. And you wouldn't use that in practice to calculate anything. You would use many more points. And if you do the same thing with 100 points, the difference would be much smaller. Maybe you wouldn't even see it in a plot. But with that scale, you can actually see the difference. OK, let me increase the font size here again. Okay, that was a training exercise to calculate the derivative of a function. And with that, we should now be able to solve the partial differential equation. Give a particular choice for a partial differential equation. Not really. Pardon?
The diffusion equation.
Diffusion equation, yeah, I wanted a hyperbolic one. The diffusion equation, we can do it, yes. The difficulty there is going to be that we need a very small time step size. But we can do the diffusion equation. The diffusion equation contains a second spatial derivative, so we need to implement a second derivative of function, I mean, a function for the second derivative. Let's do that. Call it deriv 2 for a second derivative. And for the second derivative, now I erased my point. My sketch. You have the discrete function. And at a particular point, you lose the two neighboring points. And then you can just inscribe a parabola here and look at the curvature of that parabola. And you know that this distance here is h. And then calculate the curvature here. Obviously, that does not work at the boundary points because there is no road point. So at the boundary point, you need to calculate the whole everything one shifted to the left. So let's do the similar thing. Derivative, let's call it derivative two coefficients because two for second derivative. Let's do the normal case first. Yes?
Why can we not apply twice the function derivative?
Yes. Yes, you can do that. But if you calculate the derivative with finite differences, I emphasize the point that the derivative of a piecewise linear function is piecewise constant. That falls out of the vector space, so that we need to project back into our discrete space. And if you calculate two successive first derivatives, you calculate a derivative, project back, calculate a derivative, project back. And the discretization error is smaller if you do it differently. If you calculate the second derivative and then only have one step projecting back. You can do both, and then you can again look at the differences. And the same here, the difference between discretization and calculating derivative, you will see a difference here. And as a rule of thumb, it's easier to introduce as little error as possible. But what you suggest is totally possible. It's just at certain inconveniences. So the equation to calculate the second derivative is this. It's f of I plus 1 plus f of I minus 1 minus twice the coefficient at point I. So it's this one minus 2 this plus this and divided by h squared, the second derivative. You look skeptical? OK. So let me just copy this to the other points here with a suitable offset. And that's then a second derivative. Derivative 2 of g
for the edge cases, aren't you calculating the second derivative for the points?
Yes. For the edge cases, I can't calculate a second derivative here. So the best thing one can do is calculate using this and this point, which is actually the same as calculating it for this point. It turns out that if you actually calculated it for this point using these three points here, it's the same as calculating it for this point here. It was different for the first derivative. It's just if you do the math, that actually comes out. It was different for the first derivative. For the first derivative, we have a one-sided difference here, and then for the other points, it's a centered derivative that you're getting here. But you can write it out cleanly as give me the best approximation of a first derivative using these three points, and then this is what actually comes out. Okay, I want to do a plot again just to make sure that I actually didn't have any weird error in here. DDG 11. And that's and another plot command just to see what's happening. And this kind of looks like a second derivative. Looks good. Okay, so the first ingredient for solving PDEs is being able to calculate derivatives. And the other ingredient will be to be able to integrate in time using a Runge-Kutta method. How familiar are you with these Runge-Kutta methods? Should I walk through you slowly, or should we just quickly code up the respective function? Okay, so next I'm going to implement a function that takes a function as well as the time derivative of that function at a time, and then takes one time step into the future for a given time step size. And that means if we have initial condition for a function and the PDE, we can use the PDE to calculate the time derivative of the function, and then we can go one time step in the future, and then so on, can iterate until we hit the final time and can plot the things at all times.
Can we just see the cells that you just wrote?
Pardon?
Can we just see the previous cells?
Now let's write it down a bit more generic. So Runge-Kutta integrator, I want to write it generically, not just for particular functions that are integrated, but so that it can be used for anything, because the only thing that a Runge-Kutta integrator needs, that ODE integrator needs, it needs to act on a vector space. And since I want to keep the code generic, I'm not going to put any type annotations here. So, but let me write a comment describing what this function does. Take one, RK2 is a second order Runge-Kutta I want to implement, step with F is the right-hand side function. F is the, Y is the state vector. H is the step size. And the right-hand side is a function that takes as input a state vector and produces as output the derivative of the state vector. We are integrating an ODE. So it's kind of y goes to dy or something, y prime, actually. So that's a generic function that we're going to write that takes as input three things. A function that is kind of the ODE that is supposed to be integrated, that calculates from a state vector the derivative of the state vector. We take as input as well y, the initial state vector, and a step size h. And what the output then is something is output is essentially, how should I say it? It's essentially y of 0, and the output is then y of h, or approximation of y of h. Now, it might seem complicated since we're integrating a whole function in time, but as you integrate an ODE, it doesn't really matter that the function is a complicated thing. The function is just a vector, and we're just integrating a vector. So let me.
I'm putting the derivative.
Pardon?
You said a plus is approximation of y of h.
Yes, I'm trying to just catch to see what I mean, to describe what I mean. So there is a this is y, the direction, and this is x, the direction it's we want to integrate. And here I'm just going to assume y is a scalar. In the end, it's going to be a vector. It's the same thing, and the vector can be a complicated function of not or not. Then there's a particular starting point. This is x equals 0. And here we have, say, h. And then this is the trajectory of y. And there's an ODE. And the ODE is probably y prime of x equals some complicated function of y and maybe of x and so on. And this is what I call f, the right-hand side. Well, actually, this is the right-hand side here. F of y of x, complicated. So this is the ODE that is going to be solved. And for a given y, you can calculate the slope, y prime. And that is what that function f does. You pass it y, calculate y prime. And we also need to have y at the starting point, y0. Let me just rename it y0, because then it's easier to understand. And the second order, Runge-Kutta method, works as follows. So essentially what we're going to do, we have y here, then we calculate the slope, then we take that slope to extrapolate how y looks at a different point here, say here, calculate the slope here, then we have this slope here, and this slope here can calculate a better approximation, and so on. I think you said last time you're familiar with Runge-Kutta methods. So the, let's call it k1 equals f of y0. So we calculate the right-hand side for the first time. That's the initial right-hand side. Then we calculate, evaluate the right-hand side the second time. Now let's call it, let me write it down slightly different. K0 is the right-hand side at 0. Then we calculate y1 equals y0 plus 1 half times k0. What? Yes. So the method that I'm particularly going to implement a simpler function. Here is h over 2. I'm going to take the slope here. I'm going to extrapolate the function here to h over 2, calculating the right-hand side again here. And then using this right-hand side, I'm going to extrapolate from here to the final time. And the idea, this is more accurate than taking a single step. So the first line here, k0, evaluates the right-hand side at the initial time at k0, which is why I call it k0. Then y1, the first approximation of y that I'm going to make, is at h over 2. So the value of y here is just the original y plus h over 2 times the slope that was calculated here. That is this one here, y0 plus 1 half times k over 2. Then I calculate the right-hand side here again, call it k1. K1 is then f of y1, and then y2. The other approximation is I start at y0 again. What? No, h over 2, sorry. H times k1, this is the slope we have here. I take this slope at the starting point, go to the final time, and this is the final approximation I'm using here. So the result is going to be y2. And one of the beauties of Julia is that this is a really a completely generic code. It works for all the types. You can pass for f, for y0, or h. It can be real numbers. It can be complex numbers. It can be one-dimensional arrays, multi-dimensional arrays. It can be our function types, etc. And it's the same compact algorithm. And if you open a textbook and look at the description of the second-order Runge-Kutta algorithm, there's going to be a few lines that look approximately exactly like this. Now, to test this function, I want to solve in scalar ODE, just to make sure everything works. Yes?
So on the second line, is that h over 2 times k0 or h over?
That's h over 2 times k0. This thing is evaluated left to right, so that's why it's h over 2. And also write it like this. It's not h over 2 k0, if that was the question. So how do we test that? Test it. I'm going to solve a very simple ODE. Any ideas for a simple ODE that we can test? Pardon? Okay. That's maybe not as simple as you think because it has two variables, right? There's the state and the velocity, unless you write it with a complex number. So which one do you want to use? Okay. Okay, let's use the harmonic oscillator. So the state vector will be a tuple of two numbers, the position and the velocity. And then we need to define the ODE, a function that takes as input the state vector and produces as output the next state vector. So you have a position and a velocity. And the derivative of that is the derivative of the position is just the velocity, and the derivative of the velocity is minus the position or something, probably. What? Yes? No? Maybe? You want coefficients in here? Good. Let's do that. And I'm just going to use a tuple. I'm not going to give them any names. So state is going to be a tuple. And then we have the position and velocity is the state. And then we have the derivative is the velocity and minus the position. The harmonic of 0 and 0 is 0. And if the position is 1, then the acceleration is minus 1. And if it's at the origin and moving to the right, then, well, then it's going to move to the right. So let's take an RK2 step of a harmonic. This is the right-hand side function. And start with a pendulum that is at the origin with a velocity of 0. Hope that it works. Oh, this is not good. Okay, maybe I need to explicitly use floating point numbers here. Okay, maybe I should have used an array instead of a tuple. Okay, if I start with a pendulum that's at the origin at rest and take a Runge-Kutta step, it's still at origin and at rest, that looks good. If I move it a bit to the right and take a Runge-Kutta step, then the position moves from 1 to 0.5 and the velocity changes from 0 to minus 1. That seems correct for a one time step. So what this Runge-Kutta integrator does is it takes one time step. We want to take many time steps, n time steps, and produce a respective array. So let's define a function for that. It takes also an input n, the number of steps that we want to take. And the result, we start by putting y naught in there, and then we have a loop for n in I in 1 to n, push, y1 equals rk2 step, f comma y naught comma h, then we push y1 and the result, and then we set y0 equals by 1 and then return the result. When I'm doing live coding like this, then one of the problems, of course, I'm not quite sure at what speed to move, because half of you will be bored at the slow type at which I'm speed at which I'm typing, and the other one, half of you will be having trouble keeping up typing that into your own laptop. So you need to tell me whether I'm too fast or too slow.
Does push just append to rest?
Yes, yes. I think if you have append, it takes two arrays as input and appends them to each other. And push takes an array and an element and it appends the element to the end. And then we do 10 steps. Maybe I should have taken 20 steps. That would make it more obvious. Okay. Since you're typing, let me scroll up, and then you can see the RK2 integrate function again. So, the idea behind this RK2 integrate is really rather simple. You just repeatedly apply this RK2 step function to the result of the previous one. So if you call it with n equals 10, it just does 10 RK2 steps, one after the other. And I'm also having this result, this array, which I call result, which just accumulates all the results. So if you're doing 10 steps, then it remembers all the intermediate function values that you can plot the function in the end. Okay, and let's look at the output here. Do you notice something funny about the output? So in this column, the first one is the position of the pendulum. The second one is the velocity. And so we start with the pendulum that is at position 1 on the right and with the velocity of 0. So you would kind of hope that this bounds the movement. But if you go further down, the pendulum swings to the left to a position minus 0.135. That is, it swings further. And then it swings to the right to 1.8, to the left, minus 2.3, and so on. And in the end, it's always at position 10. So the pendulum gains more and more energy as we integrate in time. And it shouldn't. That's not physical. And I think what we're seeing here, is just the inaccuracy of the integration. So every time you take a time step, you make a small error. And if you take steps that are too large compared to the length scale introduced by the curvature of the function, you get problems like that. So the way to resolve that is to take smaller time step sizes or to use a different integrator. But here I want to use a second order Runge-Kutta integrator. So the time step size here is 1.0. Let's take time step sizes of 0.1, and then the problem should be resolved. Yeah, now I need to, of course, the problem is if I take a time step size of 0.1, I need to take 200 time steps to get to the same physical time at the end. But if you scroll at the bottom here, you see that the error is no much smaller. It doesn't go to a position of 10 anymore, only to a position of 0.93 or similar. Actually here, look, the position is 0.999099, so that looks pretty good. I mean, that you could also calculate. So if this was a real thing, for example, if this was your homework assignment, then I wanted you to calculate the energy of the system or something else that is conserved. It's always a good idea. And then you can look at how the energy evolves in time. And if this is a stable evolution, then the energy would probably slowly decrease over time due to discretization error. And if the energy increases over time, then you have an unstable system. And solving ODEs is something that is fairly straightforward. There exist many algorithms. So depending on your code, you would not implement that yourself, usually. You would rather use a black box package for that. Julia has a large set of packages for differential equations, not so much for hyperbolic differential equations, but for ODEs, definitely. And you could use an ODE solver there. And the ODE solver there would not use a second order approximation, would probably by default use a fourth or fifth order approximation, would choose the step size automatically to reduce the error. And then you can also give a tolerance. For example, say I want the error to be at most 10 to the minus 8, and everything would happen automatically. So the state of the art there is pretty advanced. Okay, should we put things together now? Should we set up initial conditions and then apply the RK2 time integrator to the diffusion equation? Okay, let's do that. So for the diffusion equation, the state vector is not just an array or a tuple or something, but the state vector is one of these discrete function objects that we have. And diffusion equation is, of course, rather simple. You just take the second derivative. So the diffuse function of some function f, 1 of t, f, let's just call it f, is, of course, just the second derivative of f. And then we have some initial condition, that is the Gaussian. And let's take one RK2 step of our diffusion function. And the initial condition is we wanted to use the Gaussian, that is G11 coefs. I should have chosen better names. And the time step size, let's change one again. Float, fun, float. Oof, what is wrong now? Oh, okay. So it wants to multiply things because I mentioned vector spaces. You can scale vectors, but that's not something that we implemented. So I'm going to need to fix that in the beginning in a similar way that I needed to fix the addition last time. So I'm going to take this one here, the add function, and quickly change it into a multiplication. Some factor A of type T times a function F is just A times the coefficients. See whether it works now. I'll let you type it. I want to first make sure it's actually correct. No, what? Int? Ah, okay, int, I need to use a float here. Yeah, it worked, kind of. The numbers are very large, who knows what that means. Okay, I'm scrolling up. And this one here, number 70, is the one I entered. It's a bit similar to the add function, but when you add, then you add two vectors, f and g. Can you read that, or should I switch the light a bit dimmer again? So when you add two vectors, whereas for the multiplying, you multiply a vector by a scalar. So the first argument is no different. The first argument is just a scalar of type t, not fun of t. And the second argument is the function of type fun. And then multiply the scalar times the coefficients, and then create a function out of that. Okay. I'm looking for a respective plot command because we took one time step. I want to show what happens after that time step. So the original function was this one here, right? G11 coefs. This was the original function, the discrete function. And after one time step, I need to call, give this result a name. And this is the result after one time step. Let me make it a bit smaller, then you see both at the same time. And if you look at the scale here, that is 10 to the 3. So if we're taking this function here and applying the one step of a diffusion equation, and the result goes from 1 to 10 to the 3, that obviously is not supposed to happen. And the problem is exactly the same problem that we had with the ODE here before. We're taking a time step size that is much too large. There's a limit on the time step size that you can take to be stable, and it's of the order of 1 over h squared. H is 0.1 here because I have 10 point. So I assume if I take a time step size that is larger than 0.01 approximately, the thing should be unstable. So using a time step size on 1 here was of course much too large. I'm taking a smaller time step size, let's take 0.01. Sorry, I'm running out of names for functions. Let's call it G11C because you called it G11B earlier. And then the result looks like that. That looks a bit better, right? If you look at the location of the peak, it goes from 1 to something like 0.8. At the left edge, everything is flat, so diffusion shouldn't do anything. It kind of stays flat here. And if that peak moves out, it becomes wider. And here at the right-hand side, things should probably go up. So things went up a bit from 0 to 0.1 or something. It's not obviously wrong what happens here.
Can you do things like, you know, in Mathematica, you can just do like a list of plots. So your plot on
the side. Good idea. Do you know how to do that?
Mathematica.
No, in Julia. I should totally do that. Yes, I didn't think about that. I'm just not familiar with that. Yes, you totally can do that. I should probably just try it out. Okay, I'm going to look it up in the documentation. Okay, let me just use a multidimensional array and see what happens. That did not work out. I'll try another thing here. And after that, no, I don't know how to do that. Sorry. Okay, that was one Runge-Kutta step. Next, of course, I want to integrate. So I'm just going to use the RK2 integrate function. For 100 steps. It's kind of a series of G11s. Plotting the result. This was the initial one. Then after one time step, it looks like that. After 10 time steps, it looked like that. Oh no, it's still unstable. Okay, I'm going to reduce the time step size. Oof, it stays stable. And it probably becomes more round over time. Yeah, it would be really nice to be able to plot them on top of each other. I'm totally have to look that up.
Sorry, can I see the cell above that?
Sorry, we're just... Yes. No. I'm just, since I'm live coding, I'm a bit nervous that it's actually not right. Okay, so the cell above that was just calling the integrate function with a time step size of 0.001, a really small time step size, and doing 1,000 time steps. Yeah, and after 1,000 time step, the function looks like that. And that is obviously not quite right because the function has become negative. That should not be the case. If there's a diffusion equation, things should just diffuse out. Things should not become negative over time. That's some error. I don't know why this happens. It could be that there's a slight error with the boundary condition, or it could be that this is just an error from the time integrator that it overshoots a bit and thus generate something negative. So the way to, of course, to continue from here would be to try different spatial resolutions. At the moment, it's 10 points. That's simply coarse. And also change the time step size to see how that converges here.
The normal case number one after the G11 series.
Pardon? Oh, so what I'm calculating here with this RK2 integrate,
yeah.
It does 1,000 time steps, and then it reduces a large array that is now a time series. It's kind of a 2D array that you're getting here. And this, since I'm doing 1,000 time steps, that 1,001 is the last element here, the smoothest one. Yes?
How do we set the boundary conditions?
The way to, so there are two kinds of boundary conditions. You can have a boundary condition for the right-hand side function. In this case, you would, when you cut the right-hand side, just introduce a special case for the boundary points. Kind of similar what I did for the second derivative doing something special here. You can, for example, say the right-hand side for the boundary points is always zero, then things are constant in time. And another way is a bit more complicated, which is why I didn't show it here, is that after every time step, you apply a boundary condition. It's kind of like a projection operation. You need to write a second function, not just for the right-hand side, but also for the boundary condition, that gets the current state vector and applies the boundary condition by modifying the state vector. And for example, if you want to impose a sine wave as a boundary condition, something that changes in time, it would then do the right thing. And in your time integrator, you would also need to change it. Currently, it only calls the right-hand side function. It would then also call the projection function that projects back onto the boundary condition. It's a bit more complicated. You can also mix it back together that the right-hand side first applies the boundary condition and then calculates the right-hand side. Then it fits into one function, but that also might make it a bit more complicated. Oh, there's yet another way to do that. If you know the boundary condition, then what you store in your function is everything except the boundary values. And then when you calculate the derivative at the boundary points, you kind of invent the boundary value, and then that missing point here outside, you can just, you know it, and then when you calculate the derivative, you know what to apply there. Okay. This concludes my lesson for today. I'm sorry that I did not yet give feedback for the homework. I wanted to do that before that lesson. The homework for this module is going to be to solve a hyperbolic partial differential equation, for example, the wave equation. And I described it in the GitHub repository. In addition to doing what I did here, I'm expecting code that's a bit more cleaner than what I wrote here in a JupyterLab notebook. And you should study how the solution changes as you change the resolution. It needs to converge as you increase the resolution. And you also need to calculate some analysis quantity, for example, the energy. If you have a wave equation, and in particular, if you put the wave in a box, say in a periodic boundaries or in a box with the Dirichlet boundaries, then energy is conserved. And that's a good test to apply. If the energy increases, you have an unstable scheme. If the energy is exactly conserved, well, that would be a coincidence. I don't believe that should happen. And if the energy slowly decreases over time, that's then a measure for the error that you're making. And it should slowly increase over time just for stability. I mean, the ideal case would be energy conservation, but that's very difficult to achieve. So what people typically go for in numerical simulation is to allow a very slow, gradual decrease of energy. And if you take energy out of the system, it tends to make it more stable than when you inject energy into the system. And if you have more complicated boundary condition, for example, where you move something on one side or where you let things propagate out, then the energy conservation, of course, looks more complicated. The wave is allowed to leave the box, then the energy will obviously decrease over time. Okay. Do you have further questions to these methods? This is obviously just a very short, brief sketch, and it's probably a bit rough following the lesson. You're not familiar with that.
I just have a question because one of my plots wasn't, I can't figure out where it's wrong.
Okay, yep, I can help you. Oh, next week is reading week, so there won't be any lectures or anything, and Wednesday is family day, I believe. So we'll continue the week after that with Fourier transforms. And I have the feeling that the theory I presented was a bit harsh. And the coding here, I'm a bit leading you by the hand. I need to let you be more independent. So for the Fourier transform, I'll produce less theory and more an introduction on how to use the package. And then on the respective Wednesday lecture, you can then code by yourself. And I will walk between the aisles and help you out.